Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're recording on Thursday morning, so we're recording before Joe Biden gives his State of the Union address. I want to take 2 points of personal privilege. One, my dearest friend, Mary Lou Sayer, died at the age of 103 this morning, Thursday morning. She actually started life the year women got the right to vote. So can you imagine that incredible arc of history? She also became my friend because when I became the first female nominee for governor, as I was beginning my campaign, I remember my first speech in Concord, New Hampshire. And of course, you remember everyone in the room. And so there was about 60 or 70 people, mostly older women, by the way. And I sort of noted in my head who was there. And then I gave 3 or 4 more speeches. And this one woman, who turned out to be Mary Lou, kept showing up at all these different speeches in and around Concord. And finally, I approached her and I said, "So who are you? And are you stalking me?" And she smiled and she said, "No, I wanted to make sure you were real, that you were authentic, that I could trust you." And I said, "Well, can you?" And she said, "Yes, and I want to help you, and I hope you win." That was 1991. We became best friends from that moment on. She became my bridesmaid in my second marriage when she was 81. There is not anything I wouldn't do for her. And we knew that the end was near. Remember, she's 103. She stopped playing bridge twice a week just 2 weeks ago. This is my friend, Mary Lou. And if you want to know about the best of politics, it brings you human beings like Mary Lou into your life. That was the gift of running, even the gift of losing. So that is going to be my sort of opening salvo. And then really quickly, before I grab our first guest, I really want to share this because, again, I think we're living at a time where all we remember are people's imperfections. And we don't notice that sometimes out of that imperfection comes something even more important, which is maybe the beauty of that imperfection. And I wrote, "You may have heard of the term kintsugi. It is the Japanese art of putting broken pottery pieces back together with gold. Built on the idea that in embracing flaws and imperfections, you can create an even stronger, more beautiful piece of art." Now let me share this story a friend of mine sent me on Facebook. An elderly Chinese woman had 2 large pots, each hung on the ends of a pole, which she carried across her neck. One of the pots had a crack in it, while the other pot was perfect and always delivered a full portion of water. At the end of the long walks from the stream to the house, the cracked pot arrived only half full. For a full 2 years, this went on daily, with the woman bringing home only 1.5 pots of water. Of course, the perfect pot was proud of its accomplishments, but the poor cracked pot was ashamed of its own imperfection and miserable that it could only do half of what it had been made to do. After 2 years of what it perceived to be a bitter failure, it spoke to the woman one day by the stream. "I am ashamed of myself because this crack in my side causes water to leak out all the way back to your house." The old woman smiled. "Did you notice there are flowers on your side of the path, but not on the other pot side? Well, that's because I've always known about your flaw. So I planted flower seeds on your side of the path. And every day while we walk back, you actually water them. For 2 years, I've been able to pick those beautiful flowers to decorate the table. Without you being just the way you are, there would not be this beauty to grace the house. Each of us has our own unique flaw, but it's the cracks and flaws we each have that make our lives together so very interesting and rewarding." Joining us right now is someone who I have recently met, in part because Scott Braddock, who's the editor of the Quorum Report, on occasion has to be in a flight traveling somewhere around Texas. And he suggests, maybe you should get Harvey Kronberg, the publisher of the Quorum Report, who actually hired me. And I thought, oh my God, anytime I get to talk to Harvey, what a joy. And of course, this is the best time to talk to Harvey Kronberg. One, because we just saw the primary in Texas. It was Super Tuesday, but it was also Super Texas Tuesday with their primary. And Harvey wrote an amazing, withering, brutal, amazing, I gotta say the word amazing again, piece about Governor Abbott. I read it, Harvey. I reread it. I posted it on Facebook because it's above the paywall. And it's entitled, "It's Long Past Time to Call BS on Greg Abbott." So with no further ado, welcome back to the program, Mr. Kronberg. And thank you for writing this piece. It written with such a knowledge of Texas, such a knowledge of this man, such an understanding of what an incredible, incredible disappointment he is, and how he is now doing so much harm, not only to Texas, to the Republican Party, but frankly, when you realize that as Texas goes, so goes the country, he's actually harming us as well. So thank you so much much for joining us and share with my audience this piece you wrote, because I would describe it as majestic disappointment.
Well, I've known Greg Abbott actually since the early 1990s when he was a Supreme Court justice. He's always been an engaging conservative, cheerful, and but obviously very ambitious. I've watched him morph over the last 35 years into a celebrity-driven individual who will essentially dance for whatever the new shiny conservative object is. He been fairly unpopular inside the Republican primary for a long time. A year and a half ago, he wouldn't even go into the state Republican convention because he would have been booed, much like our senior senator John Cornyn was booed for 25 of the 30 minutes he spoke. But Greg Abbott discovered the border, and he discovered busing migrants to other cities, and he ended up capturing that issue. And that's the number one issue for Republican primary voters. It's now intruding into even Democratic voters. And he's suddenly the celebrity du jour. He's on a national personality. He's even upstaged the president, the former president, on border issues. And he decided that vouchers is the cause, the conservative cause du jour. And I should put in context, a legislative session is typically only 140 days out of every 750. He could not get the ball across the stage. And he's created a coalition essentially of libertarian billionaires and Christian nationalists. The issue he's trying to use to dominate the legislature is vouchers, but that's not what he went out and beat all of these pro-public school Republicans on. It was based on his new celebrity on the border. So my profound disappointment is, the truth is always the first casualty in political campaigns.
Of course.
But rarely do you have the governor of the state of Texas in 21 House races doing commercials, looking in the camera, and lying directly to the voters. What that means is that obviously the people he endorsed appreciate not having to spend a lot of money defending themselves. We had a billionaire bring give him $6 million, which was essentially just a wash through to go after these folks. We had we'll find out another $10 or $15 million come in from outside the state. And it was just a tidal wave of negativity. That's not the issue. That happens all the time. The issue is that the governor of the state of Texas looked in the camera and directly lied to voters. He was disproportionately successful, partially because there was never any doubt in the Republican primary that Donald Trump was going to prevail. So it was low turnout, and they are very good at targeting the most inflamed. Add to that the fact that Texas is really exploding, obviously, in population, and most of these state reps have added 20 to 40,000 new residents and some voters since redistricting. Many of these are, rural Republicans, well known in their communities. People go to church with them. But when you end up having this kind of explosive growth, as one state rep told me, he was actually block walking in unfinished new subdivisions, trying to find occupied houses. And of course, these people have never heard of him. The only source of information they have is social media and the misinformation campaigns run by third parties and the governor of the state of Texas.
We cover Iowa and we cover New Hampshire. And what we're seeing happening in Texas is very similar to what Governor Reynolds did in Iowa. Governor Reynolds, too, made vouchers her prime target. She was not successful initially, in part because of rural Iowans, who are a lot like rural Texans, that the school is the most important. It's the most important physical thing within a small community. It is not just Friday Night Lights. It's not just football. It is the biggest employer. It is really the Velcro that holds a community together. And so they oppose vouchers. And so a lot of rural Iowans, like a lot of rural Texans, did not support vouchers. And for the longest time, were able to keep it from coming to fruition. So what Governor Reynolds did a number of years ago was realize that if she's going to get her vouchers, she needed to remove them. And she removed them, and then she got her vouchers, okay? Well, what we saw this year was exactly the same thing, only this time Governor Abbott could not get his vouchers. He was unsuccessful trying over and over again. And basically his revenge was, I'm going to go after you, and I'm going to make sure that I bring all the billionaire money you were just describing, that we're going to lie in front of the camera, that we're going to take these people out. And what I think is so sad about Texas versus the Iowa story is nobody is moving to Iowa. People are dying in Iowa. Iowa is just an aging state. People are leaving it in droves. Texas is the reverse. Texas is a place where, you know, thousands and thousands of people are moving in on a daily basis. So part of the problem is that what used to be rural and you would know your neighbors for 40 or 50 years is now rural, but as you just described, has a lot of new people, a lot of new developments. And so their understanding of how important the school is to that community, their knowledge of that state rep, that just sort of sense of history doesn't exist. And for Governor Abbott, that meant he could lie like crazy about these reps because nobody even knew their names. And, you know, he could use a bait and switch. And everyone knows that the border is the toxic issue. And why mention vouchers when you can lie about the border and then you get the voucher rep that you want. And then ultimately, you know, when it's too late, all those rural communities will realize, oh my God, what have we done? But guess what? Abbott will have accomplished the task and they will have lost. It is so sad what you wrote about, but you also write about something else, which I think is really important because we hear the term rhino and you have now said, you know what? We need to sort of disabuse ourselves and no longer use the term rhino because it's meaningless. Now we need to use the new term du jour, chin, C-H-I-N, not as take it on the chin, but as in Christian in name only. And you are so harsh, but I so agree with you. I could have written every word you wrote that Christianity today under this Christian in name only has more aligned with the Taliban vision of Islam than any vision that would incorporate justice and compassion. And you are absolutely, absolutely right. Everything we were afraid of that, you know, we saw coming out of the madrasas, coming out of the Taliban, all the intolerance, all the fear of Sharia law. Well, they're basically embracing Sharia law. They just don't use the word Sharia. But in the end, when you look at what they're doing, it's exactly what they're doing. And yet they're winning because the billionaires are using them to accomplish their own tasks. And I think I got to ask you, Harvey, it's not just about vouchers. What do these billionaires want out of Texas that they're not already getting?
Oh. Well, interesting question. I do believe, for instance, this the fellow that contributed $6 million to Greg Abbott, ironically made a good portion of his fortune off of TikTok, being an early investor in TikTok. And of course, TikTok is toxic inside Republican circles. So there's a sense of irony. I don't know that he is particularly looking to profit, but there is suddenly, if we do subsidize private schools, it's a new possible profit center. We're talking about $10,000 per student going to private schools. And right now, most of the private schools, particularly south of in South Texas, are Catholic, and they're seeing declining enrollment, partially because of the cost. I've got to presume there's business opportunities in there, but the Christian net, we have this convergence between the libertarian billionaires from the East Coast and California, and the Christian nationalist billionaires from the Permian Basin. In some ways, oil and water, with two separate sets of goals. I do not believe that the out-of-state billionaires want to see the elimination of the barriers between church and state, but the Permian Basin, the oil billionaires here in Texas certainly do. And it was just a marriage of convenience. I do think that there is people want to attribute financial incentives or benefits to the voucher movement. That may be true, but I also believe that a lot of these billionaires are Milton Friedman libertarians, and Milton Friedman long ago had kind of established competition in schools as the remedy for whatever failings were perceived in public schools. But having said that, we've underfunded public schools deliberately now for the last three sessions, despite this explosive growth. So I can't prove it, but it seems like there's a deliberate effort to break public education.
Right. It's a push-pull. You know, if you drain public schools, they fail. And if schools fail, then you want the option to get out. And if you want the option to get out, then vouchers give you $10,000 and you get to get out. But what people don't even understand, again, and we were talking about just this the other day, Harvey, is that people think that it's about parental choice. Ultimately, it's about school choice. Because the only place that can never say no to a child is a public school. But if
That's
you
correct.
Go to a private school or if you go to a religious school, they get to say yes or no. Initially, some of them will say yes just because they want the cash. But eventually, they're going to start saying no. So it's not going to be about parental choice. It's going to be about private school choice. And it's going to be about, you know, Christian school choice. And the only thing is that you're using public dollars basically for your kid to be told no. It is so shocking. So I have one other question, though, because I know we don't have a lot of time. What about the lieutenant governor and what about the attorney general? Because we know that there was a move. They impeached him, but then he was not removed because the lieutenant governor, who had this sham hearing in the Senate, also was given lots and lots of money in order to make sure that he put his thumb on the scale of justice. How successful were they in getting rid of the Speaker of the House? They hate Dade Phelan. How successful were they in targeting people that ultimately voted to really support this impeachment? Because it wasn't just vouchers. It was about an attorney general who's on a vendetta.
Right. Well, the lieutenant governor actually was behind the scenes. He wasn't particularly visible when it was required for him to do some kind of eviscerating statement criticizing Dade Phelan. The speaker, he did so, but it was a collaborative effort. You had the state Republican Executive Committee censure the speaker, and all of the faux grassroots organization censure. It was probably $4 million spent inside a House district where Beaumont is the epicenter to try and beat the speaker. Now, the speaker comes from old wealth, and of course, don't forget that Donald Trump said only a fool would vote for Dade Phelan. This was a classic battle between the Republican clubs and the Chamber of Commerce. The Phelan family has been a huge factor for generations inside Beaumont. And my suspicion, they forced him into a runoff. They ran three candidates. That typically is a recipe for pushing somebody into a runoff. And that won't be until May. As far as Paxton goes, his only real success, that's the attorney general, his only real success on election night was we had three Court of Appeals judges, all very conservative Republicans, who told him that the Texas Constitution does not allow prosecutions to originate inside the office of the attorney general. And that is correct. It is not authorized. But, you know, the Constitution is for little people. And so he went after them and inside the Republican Party, saying that these three George Soros judges, and of course they're not, denied the ability to go after voter fraud. We've got to beat them. And he was successful with that. But it should be remembered, we've got about, I think, nine runoffs with pro-public school candidates in there. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of money spent against them. Patrick and Abbott, the governor and lieutenant governor, will try and deny funding to those campaign contributions to those folks. They'll let people know there's a penalty if you participate. But the thing to remember is that our indicted attorney general will be standing trial. Well, he will be deposed in the whistleblower case that will ultimately lead to federal charges, I do believe. And he, at the end of early April, actually, he will be standing in trial for securities fraud. So you have two narratives.
But Harvey, what scares me about the Republican Party, that almost feels like a badge of honor. I mean, look at Donald Trump. I mean, it's like everything is reverse. The more corrupt you are, the more they cling to you. The more corrupt you are, the better the politician they are. Since they've always been told that all politicians are corrupt, now you got somebody who's corrupt on steroids. They must be a great politician. It is so mind-blowing how up is down and black is white, and yet that's exactly what Donald Trump has been able to do successfully, and frankly, what Ken Paxton has been able to do as well. So it's so sad. It's so sad because there is no such thing as integrity and virtue. There's only basically the enhancement of corruption. And for Republicans, that's not a deal breaker. That's an invitation in.
That's pretty much the case. But I will say that actually witnessing the trial in Houston on securities fraud, and the depositions will both be public within a short amount of time. And
okay.
I'll just remind you that in most of the exit polling we've seen in the Republican primary, the presidential primary, typically 20 to 35% say that if there was a conviction, they couldn't support the candidate. I don't know how that'll play here in Texas. I know it will play strongly in the general election. Let's not forget, Beto O'Rourke, who I thought was a terrible candidate, still won in 11 of the 13 largest counties.
Right.
Ironically, the only reason Republicans are still in charge are the rural voters that they just essentially neutered in the legislature.
So real quickly, because we only have a few minutes left, we also know that the most despised person in the U.S. Senate, who apparently likes to be a podcaster and not a U.S. senator, and of course I'm referring to Ted Cruz. So tell me a little bit about the potential race against Ted Cruz and the Democrat that will be running against him.
Well, Colin Allred is an African-American with a great resume from Dallas, won the primary, which was anticipated. He's the choice of the Washington crowd. My biggest concern is that Washington folks don't know how to speak Texan. Colin Allred is quiet spoken. He has the advantage now, though, that he does not have to brand Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is a known quantity. He is largely despised. They're going to pound him, obviously, on two issues. He ran to Cancun during the winter storm that devastated the state a few years ago, which is a metaphor for his performance in the Senate. And after the Texas Supreme Court denied medically necessary health care for a woman who required an abortion, he ran from reporters and said, call my press office. And of course, the press office, they still have not issued a statement on that. So Ted Cruz is going to become the face of Dobbs, and they're going to try and make Colin Allred the face of the border. And I don't know whether Allred can get there. I see a pretty wide open path. It depends on execution. And remember that Donald Trump was the worst performing Republican to run for president in Texas history, or wow, certainly since Ronald Reagan. Instead of winning by 13 or 14 points, he won by 5 or 6 points in 2020. We don't have straight ticket voting in Texas. And the fact that Ted Cruz, they don't have to spend any money branding Ted Cruz. They only have to spend money reminding people about the branding of Ted Cruz.
I heard Colin Allred, that's his name, the Democrat.
Yes.
I heard him yesterday for the first time on MSNBC. I was aware of him, but not. You're absolutely right. He's the choice of Washington. But what I was so surprised is that he is quiet spoken. The first thing he talked about was freedom. And in his reference to freedom, he was talking about choice. Okay. It was slightly inartful, and I'm listening to him, and I'm going, oh crap, this is the guy they chose to run against the hated firebrand Ted Cruz. And unfortunately,
Correct. You know,
and we hear it all the time from Bill Clinton. It's better to be loud and wrong than quiet and right. And what Ted Cruz does is he does loud and wrong really, really well. And that's what scared me about listening to the Democratic nominee.
Well, if there's a way to lose a winnable race, Texas Democrats have demonstrated they could do that. Beto O'Rourke had $60 million. He challenged Ted Cruz, would refuse to go on TV. He challenged Greg Abbott. He was given the gift of Dobbs, never once ran a commercial on women's health care. And now we have a candidate who essentially, I've been reaching out for 3 months now, trying to just have a cup of coffee with him off the record, have not been successful. I'm not going to say I'm particularly important, but I am a gateway to campaign contributors, and we're the oldest insider publication in Texas. And despite my going off the reservation on Greg Abbott the other day, we're pretty dispassionate in our analysis. And the fact that he's only appearing in controlled environments is not particularly encouraging. Greg,
that's a huge mistake. And I need to let you go. But one last thing, because I want to bring in something that I was like, oh my God, this too. And that was Brandon Gill won the GOP primary to replace U.S. Rep. Michael Burgess, who is a Denton County Republican who is retiring after 11 terms. Why am I bringing up Brandon Gill? Who is he? He's the 29-year-old son-in-law of Dinesh D'Souza. Yuck! Anyway, who built a name for himself in widespread fraud in his film 2000 Mules. And I want to remind everyone that Dinesh D'Souza actually got a pardon from Donald Trump. You can't make this crap up. I'm just telling you, Harvey.
He was convicted for voter fraud.
Yeah, oh my God. Anyway, on that note, Harvey Kronberg is stepping in for Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is like flying around the state, and Harvey is the publisher of the great Quorum Report. Thank you so much for doing this, Harvey. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always good to visit with you, Arnie.
All right, it's a pleasure. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
In another very unsurprising campaign development, Mitch McConnell endorsed Donald Trump yesterday. In a few weeks, Nikki Haley will almost certainly do the same. And the reason this is important is because Donald Trump is just another Republican. He may be in steeper mental decline. He may be wrestling with more serious mental illness. He may be more avaricious with a deeply criminal record. But for the overwhelming majority of the Republican Party, that's okay. It's okay if Donald Trump is president. They'd rather have someone who has expressly stated they will destroy American democracy than somebody with center-left politics. That is the Republican Party. That is who they are from top to bottom. And brief boomlets of excitement for Nikki Haley because in a competitive, well, it's not really competitive, in a primary campaign, she says nasty things about her opponents sometimes, doesn't change that.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
AIDS activist Hydea Broadbent had no choice but to be brave. I'm Bill Newman. This is the Civil Liberties Minute, and that's how The Week magazine began its recent story about Hydea Broadbent. Hydea Broadbent's biological mother had been addicted to drugs, and she had been put up for adoption. Then, at age 3, Hydea was diagnosed with HIV, and she wasn't expected to live past age 5. Hydea Broadbent's HIV developed into AIDS, and the stigma around AIDS at that time was so great that if she sneezed, her kindergarten teacher sprayed her with Clorox. Hydea Broadbent was a vivacious child, and she began speaking publicly about AIDS when she was 6. She appeared on Nickelodeon, a special with basketball superstar Magic Johnson, just after Magic revealed that he was HIV positive, and on Oprah and Good Morning America. And at age 11 in 1996, she addressed the Republican National Convention where she said, "I am the next Maya Angelou. I may even be the first woman president. I am the future, and I have AIDS." As Magic Johnson said, Hydea changed the world with her bravery. Thanks to her, millions were educated, stigmas were broken, and attitudes about HIV/AIDS changed. We are indebted to Hydea Broadbent for her courage and activism and mourn her passing in February at age 39. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Thursday morning, the morning before the State of the Union address by Joe Biden, which is greatly anticipated. I want to explain why Bill Curry isn't here. Bill Curry lost his partner a week ago, and they had the funeral services, a celebration of life on Tuesday, and I said, take your time, take your time. So he is taking his time, and I couldn't imagine anyone who could fill in better for Bill Curry than Robert Hennelly. Robert Hennelly is a labor writer. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, broadcast and print reporter for more than 30 years. He covers federal, state, and local politics. He currently writes for WorkBites.com, Salon.com, Insider NJ. He's the author of Stuck Nation. He previously worked for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, and currently, if you turn on WBAI on Monday mornings in New York City at 7 a.m., there's Bob covering the airwaves. So, Robert, there's so much.
And sometimes you.
Yeah, and sometimes me. That's correct. That's correct. We cross-pollinate. Yes. But there's so many things happening in New York. And as you mentioned, because I said that this is going to be the morning before the State of the Union, that the governor of New York is actually going to be appearing at the State of the Union as a guest, I believe, of
yes.
Joe Biden. Is that my
no,
correct?
No, Serrano, of Congressman
Serrano.
Serrano.
Okay, oh, right. Congressman Serrano. But anyway, so you always want to notice the guests. I guess Joe Biden is inviting the families of the hostages
right.
to be his guests. So that's right. who he's inviting. So it's going to be a very interesting, eclectic group of people telling lots of different messages just in the balcony alone.
Right.
Anyway, so where do you want to start? Because I know, I mean, when you're talking about New York City, you're talking about almost every issue known to man, whether it's COVID, whether it's poor people, whether it's
the migrant problem. Struggle.
Yeah.
Right.
So where do you want to start?
So I would say that the significance of Hochul's appearance there politics is ultimately a story. You're telling
yeah.
a story. And so
right.
the narrative, we see that Governor Hochul had her big national push broke through yesterday on the wire services related to her announcement that 750 members of the National Guard and about 150 New York State police would be deployed into the subways in New York City, where despite an overall decline in crime post-pandemic, we are still seeing some issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is an example of Mayor Adams, who's a centrist Democrat on the best days, tends very much, he's a former police captain. So his wheelhouse is, he wants the New York Times to, you know, he's not so much interested in what the New York Times thinks, but he's very much interested in what the New York Post thinks.
Yes, exactly.
So he's kind of like every man, blue collar. And so the fact that you have the first female governor in the form of Kathy Hochul and the second black mayor, Eric Adams, working together, because this is a strategy they share, all works very nicely for a Democratic Party that is looking at the fact that they lost the House of Representatives to a large degree because of the poor performance in New York State in 2022.
Let me just stop you, because Robert, we had Alex Salmon on the other day from Slate.com.
Right.
And Alex was talking about the redistricting in New York. And when I read his article and I brought him on, I was like, how do I say this? Apoplectic doesn't describe it. Because what he ultimately points to is after spending millions of dollars, after replacing so many members on the court, doing all these things to basically be able to redistrict New York, knowing that New York alone could secure the Democratic majorities in the House of Representatives, they went from, what was it, five or six leaning Trump districts to like one more than they had before.
Right.
So now they have more Republican enhanced districts. And the whole rationale, Bob, wasn't that they didn't redistrict. It was basically an incumbent protection plan. So they kept the Democrats safe, but they didn't use this as an opportunity to expand more potential Democratic seats because it was better to keep those in place safe. But that hurts Congress and the Democrats' ability to regain control. So, I am so disgusted.
So as usual, and this is why you're the president of the class, you get to the essence of the Democratic Party's national conundrum.
Yes.
Because on one hand, it is about protecting institutional interests and a sure thing versus being a social movement of broad-based radical change that
yes.
uplifts the masses.
Yes.
And this is what we have been dealing with going back, I'd say, as far maybe as Clinton, And so there is this, and when you're talking with your previous brilliant guest out of Texas about these institutional interests that are so strong within the party. And so that's why, for instance, when we see this national election and you see the way that the corporate media is framing it, they wanted Trump and Biden to rematch, as much as they say the American people didn't want it. It was in their interest to have these two oppose each other, because it's a thing that would keep the country most stuck. Little did I know when I picked Stuck Nation as a Twitter handle over a decade ago, how spot on I'd be.
Yeah.
And yet, so what you're seeing here is that what gets lost in the sauce of this conversation, the way it's being framed in national politics, it's all about two white men, even though what's happening in the country is continued dislocation from an unprecedented mass death event that was particularly hit hard communities of color. Mm-hmm. And that in response, the national government unwound very quickly all manner of social supports and now had a greater spike in poverty than has been seen in the last 50 years when they pulled the plug on the expanded earned income child tax credit. And after getting to a milestone of more Americans insured than ever before during the pandemic, because we realized, oh, here's a thought. The more people are covered with health insurance, the more likely they are to go to the doctor, thus controlling infections. Yay, us! We pull the plug on that! And so the president of the United States speaks to a country tonight or last night that, to a large degree, is worse off because of the fact that the national government disengaged from all of these programs. More than 10 million people don't have health care now. And something like in New York City now, one in four children are living in poverty.
Right.
And so if President Biden wants these folks to turn out to vote, and they're about a third of the electorate, he needs to have said in the State of the Union that he at least sees them. And that's the problem. These institutional interests want to say everything is fine. The economy's better than it's ever been because they're looking at the gross national product, which is an aggregate thing the stock market uses, but disconnected from the circumstance of the American people, which is what folks like Reverend Barber want to see as a core issue.
And one of the things he could say is he could remind the American people that while the market is better and while the GDP is better and why unemployment is better and all these things, he can then remind them, but 70% of the American people spend the vast majority of their income on three things: on housing, on food, and on maybe transportation. Right. And when you look at those three things, I will tell you right now, we have not dealt with food inflation. That is something that is now eating up more and more of your paycheck.
Right.
So you're not only getting shrinkflation, which is that new term of art where you think you're buying 2 pounds when you're only getting 1 pound, but paying the same amount of money, and yet you still have to feed the same number of people. And he should talk about that and going, so my goal is that means the economy is still not working for you. And the way to get this economy working for you is to understand that a lot of the things like the child tax credit you just mentioned, we wanted to keep it expanded, but who made it impossible for us to do it, which created that spike in poverty? Let me introduce you to the Republican Party and Donald Trump's party. And he needs to remind them, this is my goal. Not only do I see you, do I see the struggle, but understand what is the impediment to repairing it.
Right. And so one of the things that I was very impressed by, I covered last weekend, a mass mobilization in over 32 state capitals in Washington, D.C., the Poor People's Campaign, which is committed to mobilizing 85 million low-wealth and low-wage voters. To give you a sense of the consequence of this group of voters, in Texas alone, that makes up 33.76% of the voting population. In Michigan, in 2016, Trump won only by 10,000 votes. As Celinda Lake, the pollster, pointed out, 970,000 low-wealth voters did not turn out in that state alone.
And we've talked about this, and I'm hoping that someday you write about it. And that is that when I interviewed David Dayen from the American Prospect about what happened with the student loans and how there was, you know, billions of dollars was given back to students so that they could, as Joe Biden said, I hope this gives you a little relief. He actually sent an email out to these students as they were getting their student loans forgiven that, you know, but what was so remarkable to me was that they didn't come up with a new program. All they did was look at the old programs from 1962 to just today and said all these students would qualify for relief. They either haven't applied, they didn't know, there are all these burdens. We're going to assist them in the policies that are freaking on the books. All we need to do is get them the check or the idea that they've been forgiven. That is also true. And you know that because you told me over and over again about how much money from the COVID relief time, about how much money for people who could like experience and qualify for Medicaid or for free lunch programs. These people, the laws are on the books. They just don't necessarily get the benefit.
Right.
Why doesn't Joe Biden go to the mat for them and then say, that's why we need you to vote?
Right, right. So a great case in point is the earned income child tax credit.
Right.
5 million households left $14 billion in the treasury.
Oh, my God.
And so if we begin to think about this more granularly, what it comes down to is when someone hasn't filed for that, that means that they are running their life on the defensive. They're not filing their taxes. They're not voting because they are so beaten down by what is a violent economy if you're poor.
Yes.
I don't think people, unless you've been in the circumstance, understand the one thing America hates more than any other thing, more than migrants, more, is poor people. And you know this from your political campaigning, that the idea of voting is about affirmation that you matter, that you have agency. And so the way to have a sense of engagement, and this is why I like the Poor People's Campaign, is to put those people in the driver's seat, because as we know in our lives, that's the way you actualize. The first step to being able to take control of your own destiny is to know that your voice matters.
And what do we hear over and over again? That this vote is your power. And if we can convince them that they can't leave their power on the table, that's what this is all about. And again, connect the power and the vote with the policy and make those connections. Let me just share something with you, because we know we mentioned housing costs, we mentioned food costs, we mentioned healthcare costs, all those things that are keeping people even poorer than they were before.
Right.
There's a story coming out of New Hampshire that they've stopped issuing housing vouchers. Do you know why? Because there are no housing.
Right, why that's give, been why happening have a here
voucher?
In New York.
All right, why give someone a voucher if there's nowhere to use it?
So
they stopped even creating the illusion that a voucher will work. So they stopped issuing vouchers. What a white flag. What a white flag.
And so the other thing that's been happening in New Jersey is, and this is another example of the Beltway being disconnected, when they unwound the policy of moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, they were not just doing it in isolation. And so they pulled the plug on all of these programs. And so, and this is the other thing that's diabolical. And I will say, it's going to cut both ways to have Hochul in the audience. One of the things that shows you we've had an ongoing insurrection, we've talked about that in the show, that we still have the Congress, the House of Representatives, is controlled by an unabashed insurrectionist who voted to overturn the results of the Democratic election in 2020 after the violent insurrection, which makes them, in my book, all complicit. The weaponization of undocumented sanctuary seekers by Abbott, you could say, is an attempt to destabilize. I mean, how have we come in a union of a nation where we're going to have one group of states, because in addition to Texas, you had Florida, Arizona, and Louisiana participate in this, that actually weaponizes the misery of undocumented people in hopes of destabilizing other sister states. Like, what is that about? Like, well, let's call that out.
But they're doing that with abortion. They're doing that with IVF. They're doing that with immigrants. And then on top of that, what are they doing? They're basically getting rid of child labor laws and saying, well, if we don't have an undocumented immigrant to be in your meatpacking plant or picking your oranges, we'll let your 14-year-old do it.
Well,
so and that, who does that, who, what 14-year-old are we talking about? A poor person's 14-year-old.
Right.
That's who we're talking about. So once again, the poor are being thrown under the bus. What did I've said this over and over again, Bob. I used to say that after the 1970s, when all those great manufacturing jobs disappeared, right, women had to enter the workforce, not because of the feminist movement, but because they still had to pay the damn mortgage and they right. still had to pay for the car. I said, and then here's what happened. By the 1990s and the late 1980s, we didn't just need a husband and a wife. We needed a menage a trois. We needed a third person to go in. Well, you know what? That's exactly what we're seeing happening. Only now, I mean, if I see another sign that says 14-year-olds can apply at Market Basket to bag or whatever, I mean, they're looking, they come up to my kneecaps. They're working. And that it isn't the wealthy and the middle class 14-year-old that's working. It's the poor kid that's working. So once again, the poor are being taken on the chin. They're saying, oh, look it, we're allowing your 14-year-old to work. That's not allowing. That's acknowledging right. you're poor.
Right. I guess one of the things about this, and I, as someone that couldn't wait to get their working papers at 13, I think it's okay to work. I was the oldest of six in a single parent household. But one of the things that is being missed here is that it also has macroeconomic consequences, because we have now created this situation where, yeah, and I have grown daughters, where you are the weight around their neck because of student debt is really slowing and retarding household formation.
Yes, exactly.
And so now the only hope we have from a macroeconomic standpoint is immigration. And so I think it's instructive that how quickly the Republican folks from Alabama snapped to it to come up with IVF legislation after their court went over the deep end.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that Biden needs to identify with, which is the aspirations of a generation that find themselves throttled by an economy which still, through centrifugal force, is having so much of the capital go to the very top.
Yes.
And so, and this is continuing. And Obama, you know, the thing about it is we do know that Biden was on the picket line of the UAW, but I do hope that when we meet again, we can say he addressed the slow walking by corporations that cynically frustrate the democratic process of union recognition, which is a major problem.
But unions are not monolithic. Look at the Teamsters. Put me on the couch. What the hell are the Teamsters thinking with their basically endorsement of Donald Trump? I mean, it's like
you think they went that far? They endorsed Trump by just taking a meeting?
I
just want to be careful there. All right, I'll
walk that back. I'll walk that back.
Right.
But I'm under the impression that it wasn't just a conversation. And maybe we need to Google this. But I am looking at this going, and you see it happening over and over again. The police, the fire unions, what do? They endorse the Republican candidate for governor. And so you've got the teachers on one side, and you've got the SEIU on one side, and then you've got the firefighters and the cops endorsing the Republicans. And it's a divide and conquer strategy.
Right.
We see it all the time. And in the end, why are they being played? Because in the end, the divide and conquer may be successful in getting Republicans elected, but it's unsuccessful in them finding a stable and secure future. Are they willing to give their? Right. Why are they willing to give up that future?
Well, and I think that the other piece of this here is there is a, and I think Biden is trying to address it, but I don't know if it's quick enough. This thing that's happening, the ongoing militarism around the world, people are, there's a kind of incoherence that's going. We're being told that climate change is a real peril. And yet we're conducting statecraft as if somehow exploding military ordnance doesn't have an impact on climate change. Like, I don't understand that. I don't understand how every choice I make in terms of what kind of container I have for my breakfast is critical to the future. And yet we continue to let Israel do what it's doing. And let the war prosecute in Ukraine as if it's the 19th century. There's something defective here of not seeing the connection. We should bring you got to close. I can see that.
No, you're doing your conductor thing. Well, no, I'm doing.
No,
I want to clarify the Teamster story, okay? Because I think it's really important. So let me tell you what I know. The Teamsters Political Committee gave $45,000 to the Republican National Committee, and that is the largest amount that they are able to contribute, the maximum amount. When did that contribution come in? It's the first time they've done this. It came in the day they met with Donald Trump.
It was required, so I'm sure.
Right, right. So I'm just telling you, Trump meets with the Teamsters leadership, and then all of a sudden the Teamsters write the largest check they are able to write, $45,000. And you're probably right. Maybe they did not connect the dots and did not endorse him. But when you realize it's Trump's RNC, you now know that Trump is the nominee. You see the maximum amount being cut on the day they meet. I hate to say it, but money talks.
It's also old school politics that are no longer relevant when you're operating in an insurrection that is ongoing.
Yes. Oh, God, Bob. So tonight you mentioned, what do you want to hear from Joe Biden? I wrote a piece about why I am making my choice. And I said that I am not voting for Joe Biden. I am voting for me. And then I explained what me wants. Okay. And what me wants basically is what I want to hear from Joe. So we only have a few minutes left. What do you think are like the top points? And again, you know that abortion is going to be central to a lot of things, although he's uncomfortable talking about abortion, but we've now made it a Democratic issue, an economy issue, a women's autonomy issue, a healthcare issue. There are so many things that abortion is so much more than. I hope he's able to connect all those dots, because each one of those dots brings in a different sphere of influence.
Right. I would say that one of the things I've been hearing in the circles I travel in is the focus on the idea of it's about saving democracy. I think that's a non-starter. I'm sad to say we let civic education deteriorate enough that just is not going to motivate people. It has to circle back on this election is about you and your family and the future of your children and your grandchildren. And it's not about two old white guys. It's about the mass of the American people who've just been through a mass death event that's taken a terrible toll, who even as we speak right now has not come to terms with the significance of that loss, nor done the basic work required to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, it's very interesting that you say this, because it's almost like you read my mind, because the piece that I posted up on Facebook, which was, you know, like why I am voting and who I am voting for. But it isn't really about, as I mentioned, I said I'm not voting for Joe Biden. I'm voting for myself. And I end this way. I have a choice, Donald or Joe. Only one has the potential to work for me. And I am selfish. And me, my children, my community, and my future are driving my choice. I'll opt for the old guy that shuffles and stutters over the obese, lying, racist, sexist huckster who grows older and more venal by the hour. All right. And again, I think you're right. It is about looking at it is what is our self-interest. And once again, turning to the politicians who, you know, are looking at their consultants or looking at the people that are writing the checks that don't care about us. And how do we hold not just Joe Biden accountable, but how do we hold those democratically elected officials accountable? Because in the end, they've had so much opportunity that they've left slip by that, you know, I'm looking at where we are today. We shouldn't be here today, Bob, because there was opportunities for them to vote differently, but they never did.
Well, we have to hold ourselves accountable. And that means reaching out of our comfort zone. And for those people that don't feel empowered to vote, engaging them in a conversation so they feel inspired to do so.
I'm hoping that happens. I'm a little bit leery that will actually happen. The other story that we did was about Emily's List, as well as what happened with the Democrats and the change in redistricting in New York. And one of the mentions about Emily's List was how they endorsed Governor Murphy's wife for election. I guess she's running for U.S. Senate.
You're going to bring that up as we're closing the door? You're killing me.
I am, because you cover New Jersey, because I want to remind everyone that the governor's wife has been a long-time Republican, a long-time Republican supporting anti-choice Republicans. And Emily's List, which stands for Early Money is Like Yeast and is a pro-choice Democratic operation, who did they endorse? They endorsed her.
The machine.
Oh, my God.
Which gets her right where we started. The social aspiration of a better country that uplifts everybody, and the one that bets on a sure thing.
And the sure thing is about someone who you can buy to get elected, but someone who won't serve the American people. With that, everyone, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We record on Thursday morning, the morning of the State of the Union Address. Joining us today, as opposed to Bill Curry, is Robert Hennelly. He is a labor writer. And if you turn on WBAI in New York City on Monday morning at 7 a.m., lucky you get to heat Robert Hennelly. Thank you so much for doing this, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. All right, everyone, we will schmooze on Monday. This is The Attitude. You